Hi, everyone, and welcome to a new episode of the Canadian Podcow. My name's Andrew Campbell, and as always, I'm joined by Sarah Sash in BC. Hi, Sarah.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going great. Kids are home from school now in the summer.
Are they done already?
They're done, and it took a whole one day for me to think, when do they go back to school? No, I'm just kidding. They're actually very helpful around the farm as they get a little older. They're very helpful around the farm. So I think I've got a lot of projects that they're very excited to do. I know it. How about your boys, Sarah?
They've got an important week left of things like going to the water slides, sports day, you know.
All of that very fun stuff. Yeah, that seems way more fun anyway. So they have requested a few vacation things. They want to go camping. They would like to go to a water park, and they would like to go to the beach. Those are the three requests that they've made. Any big summer plans for you, Sarah?
Yeah, classic parenting. When it's like, so what's on your bucket list?
That you're going to do the last week of August because you will have not had any time to do it. And the last week of August, you panic and then do something.
Well, my sister actually lives in Europe. So, and she's bringing her significant other, not sure what the terminology is, but her boyfriend and his family, who she's been with for years, but they've never been to Canada. So it's really exciting. We're going to get to all hang out in the summer and get to see, you know.
That sounds like a very exciting summer. That's way more exciting. That's awesome.
So included in exciting topics is also ProAction. We continue to offer you a number of topics in the last little while about ProAction specifically. And we're focusing on the Dairy Farmers of Canada's ProAction podcast series called Paths to On-Farm Excellence.
Stephen Roche is the director and principal consultant for an animal health research consulting firm called Acer Consulting, based in Guelph here in Ontario.
And Stephen and his team have done great work to help showcase Canadian dairy farming stories, industry updates, and the latest science advice and perspectives on high priority topics that relate to our favorite ProAction.
Today, we're bringing you a discussion between Stephen and Dr. Katie Proudfoot, an animal health and welfare researcher that works at the University of Prince Edward Island.
Katie has a great background in dairy cattle welfare, having conducted research in British Columbia, the United States, and now on the Atlantic side of Canada.
So here you can hear her perspectives on why producers should be motivated to continue to strive for improved animal health and welfare.
Well, Katie, it's a pleasure to have the opportunity to sit down with you today and learn a little bit about your perspective on all things animal welfare in the Canadian dairy industry.
I'm really happy to be here. Thanks for the invite.
So you've had a sort of a long career already in animal welfare in a number of different places. I wonder if you can give our audience a bit of a handle on some of the topics you've spent some time researching on and where you've done that research and sort of your background in the industry.
Sure, yeah. So I really started with dairy cows during my master's and PhD at the University of British Columbia at their animal welfare program. That's where I got my first exposure to dairy cow welfare research and did actually a majority of my research is focused around the time that the cow gives birth. So I've done a number of things trying to understand cow behavior during that time and how to better accommodate cows. And then after my PhD at UBC, I was hired on at The Ohio State University in the College of Veterinary Medicine, where I did a lot of teaching. So teaching is also a passion of mine. So I taught in the vet school, and then I continued doing more research along those same lines and was there for about 6 years. And then as of October 2019, I was I moved my whole family up to Charlottetown, Prince Edward Island, where I have a new position there as an associate professor in the Atlantic Veterinary College at the University of Prince Edward Island and the director of the Sir James Dunn Animal Welfare Center.
Well, that's great. So you've really had a coast-to-coast experience with research and welfare and yeah. Everything from farmers to vets to other advisors.
Yeah, and a little bit of Canada, a little bit of the U.S.
Yeah, so
it gives
great.
Me a different perspective.
No kidding. And in PEI, what are some of the focus areas of your work and the center that you're talking about in terms of animal welfare?
Yeah, so my particular work is still going to focus a lot on the cow around calving. This is an area that there's, I think, still lots of research that we can do. There's been decades of research trying to understand why cows get sick after mm-hmm. they give birth, But before my PhD, there wasn't a lot of research around the cow's behavior and some of her her needs around that time period.
Right.
So I'll continue to focus in that area, and we can talk a little bit more about what kind of outcomes that have come out of that research, because we have found a lot of really interesting things that cows do if you give them the opportunity around calving. But the center itself has a lot of interests beyond dairy cows. So there's people at AVC that study horse welfare, cat and dog welfare. We have a lot of service projects where we give money to help people with low income have opportunity to spay and neuter their animals and things like that. So the center itself is quite diverse in the animal welfare projects we have.
That's great. It's nice to have an opportunity to work with colleagues that have a probably a pretty wide variety of expertise and perspective on how to understand and improve welfare.
Yeah.
So I like to ask researchers like yourself, what got you into welfare and sort of what keeps you motivated and excited about looking at things from the dairy perspective in this case?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think my story might be a little different from other people. So I grew up in Southern California in a suburb and really had no exposure to agriculture growing up. But I always knew that I was really interested in animals and research. So when I was an undergrad, I ended up studying stress in people.
Mm.
And so my job was actually to stress people out on a daily basis, which was not the most fun job in the world. Soon realized that that's not what I wanted to do with my life and that I really loved the concepts I was learning, understanding how stress can impact the body, which is something I think every person needs to understand is how bad stress can be for you. But I wanted to take that concept and try to apply it to animals in such a way that actually helped the animals, not just helped medical research about humans. So I looked into animal welfare research and found UBC, and that's really when I realized this was a field and sort of all of my interests collided into this one field, and I've been really, really happy and satisfied since I discovered animal welfare was the science.
Well, that's great, and I think it's certainly needed. So if we do look a little bit more focused on the dairy industry today, there's a wide variety, as many of us know, and certainly those listening have experienced a number of issues that we may need to tackle. And I think we've been successful in tackling some, and yes, there are many others that we need to continue to focus on in terms of dairy cattle care. From your perspective, and you've got some from the States, which would be sort of interesting to hear, I think North America and maybe many developed countries in general that have well-established dairy programs are still experiencing many of the similar issues. What for you are some of the emerging or welfare concerns, priorities that we need to be working on from a dairy industry perspective today?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'll say, too, that although I've come from not a dairy background, during my master's and PhD, I lived and worked on a farm for almost 8 years. Mm-hmm. So that gave me I kind of have a perspective of both someone from an outside, but also someone from the inside. And I think animal welfare concerns are a little bit different depending on which perspective you take.
Yep.
So from inside the industry, I think lameness is still one of our biggest challenges.
Mm-hmm.
Some other issues I think within the industry we're dealing with are coal cows and down cows. So dealing with when a cow goes down, how are we moving her, making timely euthanasia decisions about those cows, which are not easy decisions.
Right.
It's a really complicated and emotional topic, which is why I think it is one of our biggest challenges. Things like painful procedures. So in Canada, at least in our code of practice, there is some requirements around pain control. Or I guess requirement isn't the right word. But in the States, that's not something that is in any way in our standards of care.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something that I think hopefully the U.S. follows Canada's lead on that using pain control for painful procedures is really important because that's something that we have direct control over as caretakers. So those are some issues that I think down the line are going to come up
Yep.
as also important.
Yeah, it's I like how you frame that. It's sort of the push and pull of how we respond as an industry to consumer concerns or outsider concerns. It doesn't have to necessarily just be consumers. It could be our retailers or our processors. But then recognizing there are many issues that we see on a day-to-day basis that we know we need to improve on or address just because they're not undesirable and can be painful situations.
Mm-hmm.
So I know your background in particular and some of the work you've spent a lot of time researching and trying to get a better understanding for is really behavior and the welfare of the cow and maybe the calf too. You can sort of fill me in on that a little bit around that time of calving, maybe the most stressful point in time for our animals on dairy. And so can you tell us a little bit about that? What have we learned? What are some of the key lessons learned and outcomes that producers and really anyone in the industry listening to this might benefit from knowing?
Sure, yeah. So my research, when I first started my PhD at UBC, we had a really basic question about cow behavior when she's preparing to give birth. If we look at what happens in cow-calf operations with beef cows or in wild ungulates, there's this very common behavior that happens where cows will leave the herd, will distance themselves, and will find a secluded, hidden place to give birth, like tall grass or tree cover. I think anyone that owns a cow-calf operation knows the cow, when she's calving, she's in the far back 40, yep. You know, where you can't find her or the calf. And for good reason. So it's probably as an anti-predator strategy, but also for the cow to hide herself from other cows and be able to build a bond with her calf, which is really important in the beef industry. Less important in the dairy industry because we separate them early. But our question was, do cows still have that behavior when we house them indoors in a dairy barn? Because typically we don't give them the opportunity to hide when they're giving birth. And we do sometimes move them to individual pens, so mm-hmm. we might separate them. But often those individual pens are right next to the milking parlor, somewhere in a very high traffic area where there's a lot of noise and activity. So we did a couple of studies and found that if you do give cows the opportunity to hide themselves at calving, many of them will. Not all of them, but many of them will, especially those that calve during the daytime.
Mm-hmm.
At night, they don't seem that motivated to hide, maybe because it's already dark and quiet. But during the daytime, if you give them, for example, in one of our studies, we had an individual box stall and we just made a plywood corner. We didn't cover the whole stall because that would probably be stressful for the cow. They don't want complete seclusion because, again, they're a prey animal. But having just a little corner they could hide in. And in that study, 80% of the cows used that little corner to calve. So very easy, practical. And we've done more work in group pens, giving cows a little blind for them to hide behind. I think the only take-home message there is that cows will see that as a valuable resource and they will fight over it. So if you are going to give a group of cows an area to hide, there needs to be more than just one for a group, or you have to find a way to kind of make it something that multiple cows can use.
Mm-hmm.
But they certainly will use it if you give them the opportunity. So I've seen dairy producers kind of take that and run with it. So some have put up curtains around their maternity pens, or even just straw bales piled up within a group pen or outside of an individual pen. I had a producer that put up a corrugated metal wall between his maternity pen and the holding area and the milking parlor. And he said there was a lot of success with that cows seem more calm and they're able to progress through labor more normally when they have that sort of secluded area to hide behind.
Mm-hmm. Do you see any differences in parity because naturally that's where my head goes is, you know, so a cow that's experienced this process, maybe under the sort of conventional or traditional system, you know, third lactation or greater, do we see a difference there?
We did see a difference in one of our studies where we actually had the cows on pasture in Tennessee.
Okay.
And they had access to a barn and a area of pasture. And then on like the far end of the pasture, there was some tree cover and tall grass. And the heifers calved in the area with the tall grass. The cows calved in the barn. So, and I think part of that might be from previous experience. Yep. There's also some earlier work that showed that heifers that were interrupted or disturbed by other cows while they're in the process of labor were more likely to distance themselves even further. So it could be also a social dominance thing or social relationship. So we're understanding that a little bit more, but I think in the heifers that need to hide, at least in a more natural setting, but you could bring that inside a barn too, is a little bit stronger than with the cows.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like it's not a lot of work. Like you had mentioned that it's fairly practical, or it can be very practical, yeah, depending on your specific setup to make this jive. It's not like we need to completely redesign and pour new cement to create some of these structures.
Yeah, in our the latest study we did at Miner Institute in New York, we used a Jersey road barrier, which is what they use in construction. It's this big plastic empty container, and when it's not filled with water, it's about 100 pounds. You fill it with water, and it's like,
yeah,
3,000 pounds. I don't know. The cows could not knock it over, and that, mm-hmm, was, you know, our criteria for a good hide is the cow can't break it. So it's cheap. The skid loader can move around it to clean out. This was an abetted pack. You could pack around it. It was a very easy thing to install without having to drill into the concrete even.
Mm-hmm.
So, and or straw bales, I think, also are very practical too.
Mm-hmm.
And that way you can remove it if it's not working, or if you see something, you know, that you think is a better option.
Mm-hmm. And then just out of curiosity, I mean, it sounds like it's better in that we're enabling these cows to sort of express a more natural behavior in a more of an artificial environment that we've created. Do we see any changes or any differences in transition disease or other health and welfare outcomes that are beyond just that sort of short period of time?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I don't have the answer.
Yeah, I wondered if we know.
Yeah, we don't know. I would predict that it would help at least. I don't know if it'll have an impact on disease, mm-hmm, but at least it reduced stress around calving. And that could have various outcomes post-calving. We are sort of measuring that in our current study, but we don't have thousands of cows, so I don't know if we'll get a really good understanding of it. But it's interesting, though, despite not having the health side of things, it's still something that producers that I've talked to are really interested in. And I think that's really cool that it's very intuitive. Often when I talk about it, they're like, yes, I know. I can tell my cow wanted to hide, or it totally makes sense. And so people are doing it despite not having any sort of, as we know, an economic benefit and things,
mm-hmm,
like that.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's where, especially when we think about the consumer side and sort of what we sort of can communicate to the public, it gets lost sometimes that our farmers care for these animals, and we don't often need, or we don't always need, an economic argument,
yeah,
or you know, a significant difference in a reduction in disease. Of course, those things are nice, and they give us a real good, you know, sort of kick in the butt to do that. But,
mm-hmm,
it being able to ensure that these cows have a comfortable and happy existence is also a huge priority.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's a really important thing that any dairy producer I talk to agrees with. They, mm-hmm, they want to create environments that their cows are going to use and enjoy. So that's my favorite area of research for that reason too. It's not usual for a researcher to see their work in practice,
mm-hmm,
and not all the time. So it's great when I get to go on farms and they've heard that and they've done something. And I've seen some really creative things too, that I think that's something else, like be innovative with, yep, with how you do this. 'Cause there's not one way to do it.
Yep. And that's farming in and of itself.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Great. Do you want to speak a little bit to some of the behavioral work you've done at this point? I mean, you don't explicitly mention it in there, but I think it's interesting when we talk about welfare and really trying to understand dairy cow behavior. It seems like a topic we're still learning a lot about. And to use the example of pain, trying to understand the behaviors associated with an animal that can't give us a direct feedback on how they're feeling, behavior becomes so important for us to understand, because it either indicates to us that something's wrong, or in fact, this is a natural behavior that we shouldn't really be concerned about. So from your standpoint, how does behavior play into our understanding of welfare?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'll use the example of behavior changes around sickness and around pain.
Sure.
Because those are two things I'm really interested in, and there's actually quite a lot of research in those topics. Like, it seems sort of intuitive that animals will change their behavior when something goes wrong, but there's some really interesting research, not just in dairy cows, but in other animals, about how our body responds to stuff like pathogens and painful experiences. So when we get sick, any mammal that gets sick, there's this general behavioral response that happens. I think everyone knows what happens when my husband gets sick. He wants to eat ice cream on the couch downstairs watching Netflix. Like, he doesn't want to move. He doesn't want me or my one-year-old to bother him.
Yep.
He wants to be by himself. I think a lot of people have kind of the same thing when they feel ill. And that's the same with animals and same with cows. So when cows get sick, they go off feed. They ruminate less. They are less active. They want to spend more time laying down if they have a disease like metritis. Something like mastitis is kind of interesting because they actually don't want to spend more time laying down, probably because it's painful.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where pain and sickness kind of come together and make this sort of different behavior. So cows with mastitis will stand for a lot longer, but they'll stand still.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't want to use energy. And all of that is actually meant to help your body conserve energy to mount an immune response. So it's all for a purpose.
Right.
So those sickness behaviors not only can tell us when a cow is not feeling well, but it also is something that we should allow the cow to do. Give her the room to lay down and rest. Or if she has mastitis, a more comfortable place if she wants to lay down. Give her easy access to food. And in some of our work, we showed that cows that are sick will also isolate from other cows. Mm-hmm. So given the opportunity to hide, they will. So that's something else to consider, is your sick cows may be a little less social than they normally would and maybe would prefer to be in a place that is a little protected from other cows. And then for pain, there's other very specific behaviors you see. So depending on where the pain is, so for example, a calf that is dehorned without pain control or disbudded, during the procedure itself, they'll be kicking and things like that. But then afterwards, you'll see ear flicks or head shakes, and that's all associated with the pain being in their head.
Mm-hmm.
An animal that has an abdominal injury or a cow that has metritis, who has a uterine palpation, they'll show a back arch. Or animals that are castrated show that back arch. And that's another behavior that tells you that they're feeling pain and it's in a specific area of their body.
It's really interesting to think about all the nuances of that, right? Depending on where the pain is and the age of the animal too. You've done some work in calves and you mentioned some of the work related to dehorning. There's a lot of talk in Canada now about, you mentioned pain control, the need for it, revolving around how does pain control work and are there differences associated with the methods that we used? And so like something like caustic paste is something, it seems to be a conversation among different groups. Do we understand and are there important differences from a behavioral perspective in terms of our young stock versus our adult stock, other than what you've mentioned already?
I think there might be some things we don't understand yet about young animals and how they respond.
Mm-hmm.
So there might be like a very young animal may still feel pain the same way, but may not have as great a response as an older animal. Although I think we need to do more research in that. It's also a really challenging thing to measure in cattle because they're prey animals. And in general, prey animals don't want to show they're in pain.
Right.
So when a cow is showing you she's in pain, it's probably a pretty severe state at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So she may be feeling pain, even an adult, but they won't show it because it's showing off to if she was in the, you know, the great outdoors and there was predators, yep. Then she would kind of give herself a show that she's a nice little target for them. So that makes it challenging regardless of age, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, those are some, and they may look subtle, But even subtle behaviors tell you that the animal's experiencing pain. And then also with pain, you do see some of those same behaviors as with sickness. So they might just look a little depressed, like they're not eating as much. And they're just showing you that there's something wrong, even though they're not, you know, standing up and vocalizing. But a cow that's doing less behavior actually shows you there's something wrong as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's to that point about showing signs too. When I talk to consumers or even family, you know, that don't have, and I'm not from a farm myself, but like yourself, have spent lots of time in the industry. I often liken it to the household cat. You know, when they're not feeling well, it's like they disappear all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. And it's usually because there's some painful condition, and they're not they're really good at hiding it.
Yep.
So one of the things that we chatted about sort of before we started recording that I think would be interesting to get your perspective on related to behavior and, working with animals is handling. I realize it's sort of difficult sometimes to talk about handling in an audio format, but I think it's important, and we've got other conversations talking about how do we embrace as a herdsperson or, you know, a member of a team working with animals that safe, calm approach to handling our animals. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. There's been a quite a bit of research also in this area. And I think a challenge we have is that there's lots of handling skills that anyone can learn. Anyone can learn how to use a flight zone or point of balance and things like that. But it's not really the skill that makes you perform a behavior. It's your attitude. So having the right attitude towards good handling and kind of a culture of good handling on a farm is really important. And that starts from the top down. So everyone needs to be on board with what is good handling, what is appropriate on my farm, what's not appropriate, and how to step in when there's things that aren't appropriate. And from the cow's perspective, I think something we don't often think about is cows actually do recognize individual people. So there's research on that. They actually use our face. They can tell our faces apart, which is pretty strange to think about because their vision is not very good. Mm-hmm. But they can tell us apart and they can remember who treats them poorly. So there's that was shown with research that cows that were treated poorly in the past, when that person entered the milking parlor, they had a stress response, the cow, even when that person was just standing in front of them. So that tells you that if you are using some sort of negative handling, cows will, it will not only affect them during that moment, it'll affect them during an important moment, like when they're being milked. And in that same study, they found that those cows that were treated more negatively were less likely to let down their milk. So it's something that I think if a farm manager down to every employee understands how important it is, not just from, from an animal welfare perspective, also from a production perspective, a cow is going to make more milk if she is not experiencing fear and stress around the people that are around her. And that becomes a culture on the farm. I think that's really important.
Yeah, I think that's great. And I really like your comments about the attitude bit, because it really does start from there. I mean, any change, regardless of sort of the specific change we're talking about, you've got to embrace that. You've got to have the mindset, especially if you've got a larger team and our dairies are getting larger and more complex, you know, robots or whatever. We've got lots of technology, but still lots of people at the end of the day. And that presents a challenge if we're not all on the same page and, if we're not maybe embracing the approach that we might like to see. And it's nice to see that we've got research suggesting that there is value in that effort, not just from how the animal is feeling, but from some of the very real reasons we are farming in the first place, the product we're producing.
Yeah. And I'll add too that with handling, when I say negative behaviors, I don't mean animal abuse.
Yes.
And so that's
good
different.
Point.
Yeah. And so even just shouting at a cow has very, very good hearing. They have, their ears are much larger than ours, which amplifies the sound. So what we think might be not a very loud sound could actually be quite loud to a cow. Mm-hmm. And there is research, again, to show that from the cow's perspective, a shout is actually as aversive as a short electric prod. So it's something we don't normally think about is shouting. hitting the cow or doing a tail twist can be appropriate when you need to do a tail twist, but doing an appropriate tail twist and not breaking the tail, things like that are things that we don't always think about as negative handling, and they can become normal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the thing I'd add to that too is recognizing that we tend to move quicker than cows, and you know, so there's a lot associated with just the speed placement of ourselves and the way in which we move in relation to them. It's sometimes it sort of seems simple to talk about, but we all know there's frustrating situations. There's stubborn cows. There's cows that for whatever reason don't want to go some sort of place. And so that's when some of these things, like you're saying, raising your voice is an easy way to get them moving. But, you know, that can induce that stress response that we're talking about and really have a longer term effect on them.
Yeah. And unfortunately, a lot of those behaviors happen when we're trying to get them to the milking parlor.
Yes.
Especially a heifer going to the milking parlor for the first time, and the heifer will remember that. And so then you don't want to create a negative experience for that heifer. It's like if you go to the dentist and every time you go, you get a root canal, you're never going to want to go to the dentist. If you go to the dentist and they give you a big piece of chocolate after your cleaning or something, then, you know, it's you feel a lot better about it. So making it more of a positive experience, however you can, especially the first time, I think is a much easier way for everyone instead of having to constantly yell or make noises to get cows to move.
Right. So you mentioned before when I asked you about sort of emerging welfare issues or issues that we need to tackle today. And again, I like how you sort of presented that and from an internal and an external perspective. What would you say? I mean, we could have consumers listening here, and of course, you know, we are ultimately all of us in the industry responsible for ensuring not just food or safety and quality, but environmentally, we're doing what we can from an animal health perspective. We can do and that do what we can, and of course, from a welfare standpoint. What would you say some of the things that we're in the last several years we're doing well? What's working in the industry, and what? Maybe you can't attribute one thing, but generally, where are we seeing forward progress and momentum? What can we be proud of? Our farmers work hard and they're being asked to do a lot. What would you say sort of some of those shining moments for us?
Yeah, I think the Canadian dairy industry has a lot to be proud of, and especially when it comes to animal care. And I think obviously with any industry, there's room for improvements, but I think the thing that differentiates the U.S. from Canada, too, is the codes of practice, that they exist and that they set these standards of care, and they come from the industry plus getting perspectives from the public and from other scientists and other people. And then on top of that, what the dairy industry has done that's different from other food animal industries is ProAction and actually having eyes on every farm. To look at some of the things that the industry recognizes as animal welfare problems, like lameness and hog lesions and body condition. Those are all things that I think it's really important for dairy farmers to get. I mean, they have in the past done a good job preventing things like lameness, but having ProAction can help give them even more incentive to do that. So I think that is a step in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. And it can help to benchmark ourselves too.
Yes.
Right? Sometimes we don't know there's an issue, it's just the norm, and then realize there are other ways of doing it or other outcomes associated with subtle changes sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
How do advisors play a role in all of this, in supporting individual farms and getting over some of these challenges, and then maybe acting as a link to help get the research that you're doing into the hands of those that are, you know, ultimately responsible for putting that into practice?
Yeah, and I'd point out the veterinarian as one of those key advisors. And so I've had a lot of experience. I'm not a veterinarian myself, but I've been in a vet school for the last close to 7 years. So I've trained veterinarians. And we don't do a lot of training actually in animal welfare for veterinarians, but there's a lot of veterinarians that have, they have some of the expertise that dairy farmers can use to help them deal with, for example, they get their ProAction report and they need to, maybe lameness was something that they could improve. getting their, of course, hoof trimmer involved, and their veterinarian can play a very key role in helping to make good changes that make sense. Like, mm-hmm. you don't want to change just for the sake of changing. You want to change in such a way that is going to help you as a farmer improve what you're doing on a day-to-day basis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like their ability to take all of the science and all of the evidence that we have and all of their experience themselves and to help tailor that. Because every farm, as we know, is not, you know, a farm is not a farm is not a farm. There are so many little nuances. And
exactly, yeah. So then that's the purpose of ProAction, isn't to provide, here's the blueprint. Mm-hmm. You have lameness, go do 1, 2, and 3. And that's where the veterinarian and others can come in to say, in your particular situation, yep. what can we do that's not going to cost you $1 million to build a new barn?
Yep.
What are the things that we can do that will make your overall farm better?
Yep. No, I think that's great. So I like to end with sort of a big picture question. We've been talking big picture a little bit for some of these things, but as we look towards the future in a fairly diverse and very much evolving Canadian dairy industry, what do you see ahead of us? You know, what does the future of dairy look like?
That's a fun question, I think. I think the future of dairy is kind of we're going in the right direction right now. But I think it's going to depend a lot on what our society as a whole feels about how we should treat animals and how animals should be cared for. I think that we're going to see dairy farmers become more than just dairy farmers. I think we're going to see them also become beef farmers in a sense because of our bull calves. So that's another area of interest of mine is bull calves that now in Canada, we have these new changes to our transport regulations. And in the Maritimes, I already know that there are many dairy producers that are looking to look to their bull calf now as another business opportunity. And so I think we're going to see a lot of crossbreeding, mm-hmm. a lot more Angus/Holstein calves that are born. And so that's, I think, going to change the industry quite a bit.
I think that's awesome. I agree with you on all fronts. I think we're seeing that in places. You mentioned Europe for some of those things, and we don't have to look too far south to see some of the other examples like dairy beef, for example, that you mentioned. Well, Katie, it's been a pleasure to have a chance to chat with you and get inside your head a little bit and learn a little bit about your perspective and experience. And I hope that everyone else has been able to gain something from some of the specific things we talked about. So thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Meet a Canadian dairy farmer. Planting one tree, then hundreds more. To naturally purify the air. Preserving wildflowers for pollinators. And nurturing wetlands for healthier soil. So wildlife can prosper.
Biodiversity is in our nature.
Working towards a sustainable future. That's Dairy Farming Forward.
We're in!
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure to learn about Katie Proudfoot's perspectives on animal welfare in the Canadian dairy industry, Sarah.
I agree. What a fascinating career with extensive research and experience in dairy cow welfare. Her insights are invaluable. I have to say, if the kids get a little bored, Andrew, you might want to suggest that they have a listen to this one because there's a lot of opportunity in the industry and there's some really high priority animal welfare issues to tackle. And people like Katie Proudfoot are setting a great example of how that work can be guided.
Well, especially as we look to the future, Sarah, it's essential for the industry really to continue evolving and addressing these welfare challenges. And I think what we've heard today is based on a solid foundation for this progress to actually happen.
Continuous improvement, Andrew. It's all about continuous improvement. For dairy farmers, understanding and improving animal welfare is an ongoing effort that requires attention and dedication. Katie's contributions are a great example of the positive impact that focused research and education can have.
A big thanks to Katie and Stephen for the conversation as part of the Dairy Farmers of Canada's ProAction podcast series, which is partly funded by the Canadian Agricultural Partnership, a 5-year federal, provincial, territorial initiative.
And a big thanks to our production team, Carl Bellanger and Bruce Sargent, and all of those at DFC that made this episode possible.
Next time I see you, Sarah, it's going to be in St. John's as you and I are both headed to Newfoundland for a few days for DFC's annual general meeting.
Yeah, I can't wait to see you there and to get to record our next episode of the Canadian Podcast on location in a whole new type of place. I've never actually been to Atlantic Canada, so I'm excited.
Yeah, oh, you should be. It's a beautiful spot, and the folks around St. John's, one of my favorite provinces to visit. So we will see you there next time, and thanks for listening to the Canadian Podcast.